This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we continue our rebroadcasting of speeches from the Russell Tribunal on Palestine held last month here in New York City.
We'll hear a remarkable excerpt from the Palestinian lawyer Diana Bhutto.
We'll take a look at the moral challenge of so-called kill lists.
Attorney General Eric Holder says these people have got all the due process they deserve because Obama and his advisors sorted out their biographies and decided to have them murdered.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights. Michael Smith, this is Michael Ratner speaking, and we're speaking to you from a basement on a day of the second storm to hit New York, not the equivalent of Sandy, but a big, heavy, winded, rain, snow storm. Why, Michael Smith, are we recording from a basement?
Well, usually we record from the 10th floor of the BAI office over on Wall Street, which I think went underwater for a while because it's right near the river. It's still disabled. There's no heat in the building. We can't get in there. We can't work in there. So we're in a basement in the village because of a very predictable disaster, and that is the sea levels have risen. The water is warm. The energy for storms is ferocious. We've all read about that, and it really creamed us. I got evacuated from my apartment. I moved in with you, Michael, and then 14th Street transformer blew up, and we had no electricity.
Right, and so we had no electricity, so we had to flee. But, you know, we're sitting here talking, but this is really, the Sandy storm was really a disaster. And, if you know, there's still, as we speak, tens of thousands of people without electric, without food, without being able to get down their elevators, in places like Coney Island, the New Jersey Shore, and Long Island. And finally, maybe people will begin to talk about what has to be done about global warming.
The only good thing you can say about it is I think that there is some discussion now, because otherwise you feel like you're living in Bangladesh. During the presidential debates, all three of them, they didn't even mention climate change. Obama went to Copenhagen and spiked the agreement. That might have helped a little. There really wasn't a dime's worth of difference between the two parties. They're both bragging about drill, baby, drill, fracking, bringing dirty oil in from Canada. This is the key issue for the human race, and let's hope that we start that discussion because if we don't have much time. We're running out.
You know, it's not chance. I've been living in New York probably 50 years or almost 50 years, and in the last 2 years, look what we faced. We faced Hurricane Irene last year, Sandy a few days ago, and now we're having another storm. It's not chance that that's happening.
No, I live in Battery Park City, and I've been thinking for a while, maybe I should sell my apartment because this place is going underwater. And then I got a call from my son saying that an 11.7-foot wave hit the retaining wall. I'm about 200 yards away from it, and I'm down here in your place, Michael, and I talking to my son on the cell phone, and I'm thinking, my building is underwater 11 feet. Miraculously, it was like an island. The rest of Battery Park City got hit, but...
This is where we think we can beat nature. Michael's in Battery Park City. That's all built on landfill. The place in Staten Island that was really wiped out was built on an old swamp.
Yeah.
What you see happening as you move into the ocean, or as you take away the sponges that absorb the water, and then the seawater rises, you're basically done for.
We're done for. Even if they build a higher retaining wall around southern Manhattan, because, you know, they want to protect Wall Street, the water is going to hit the retaining wall, but it's got to go somewhere, so it's going to flood the Upper West Side.
Time to get on the stick on global warming. Michael, we have a couple other updates we want to bring people.
I'd like to talk about, now that the election returns are in and Obama's got another 4 years, the center has been litigating against the Obama administration in a number of key areas. Is this going to change, Michael?
Now that he doesn't have to get reelected, he's going to do the right thing for all of us.
Don't be sarcastic. What kind of issues are you litigating and are you going to continue to litigate?
Well, let me tell you, one reason it's not going to change and the issues we're going to continue to litigate are not going to change, and all these people who say he'll do better because he doesn't have to get reelected are just kidding themselves, because you have a Congress and you have the Democratic Party out there, and they still completely split Congress, and whatever decisions Obama's going to make, even assuming you thought he might make more liberal decisions, the Democrats have to be reelected in 2 years, and that's all they're going to be thinking about. They're not going to be thinking about anything else except how do we get more seats, et cetera. And then, as we talked about on this program before, we had Glenn Ford on here, and he said, well, you know, what's holding back organizing against Obama by at least the African-American community is that though it's the same constituency that wants to see a black president and supports him, and therefore they're disabled from organizing against him. And we have seen that consistently since Obama's been elected, that the fact that he got 93% of the African-American vote, et cetera. And we also see it on the issues that you're asking me about, the issues that we had support for, like some support for, closing Guantanamo, the use of drones, military commissions, warrantless wiretapping, all those issues that we're litigating against, which we have some liberal support for, but in fact, those are the same liberals who support Obama, and therefore, they are not willing to go after Obama on these fundamental bread-and-butter civil rights issues. And so what you have is this is Obama being a figure who has actually, you could argue, has disabled the liberals and the African-American communities from really taking action.
What if Obama wasn't reelected and the new president personally has a kill list and he's being advised by one of the top CIA guys who was in charge of the torture program 5 years ago? They're killing from the sky not only foreigners but American citizens. You would have a huge constituency opposing that. You're not supposed to murder people without due process, particularly American citizens. But that's the very thing that Obama's doing. It's like people are in a trance. No one's even criticizing it.
I agree completely, Michael. I mean, we have no real constituency left on these issues. We can't get the people out on them. I mean, we're trying, and I think it'll change over the next couple of years. But it is amazing how his election has disabled both African Americans as well as
liberals. Progressives. It's a very large part of people we had hoped to count on have taken themselves out of the ballgame on this.
I mean, that's not necessarily a reason someone shouldn't have voted for him, but it's just a fact of where we are right now. So these issues that we litigate at the center, including whistleblower issues, including representing Julian Assange, the Bradley Manning case, as I said, Guantanamo, military commissions, drones, prosecution of people who've been engaged in torture, all of those issues will not change even a hair unless we can get a constituency built up and continue the litigation.
Center for Constitutional Rights and the People's Law Office in Chicago had a major victory in the Mohamed Salah case. Tell us about it.
I mean, a lot of people probably have never heard of Mohamed Salah. He happens to be a Palestinian, but that after 9/11, he was put on what's called a Specially Designated Terrorist List, SDT. And they do that to individuals, they do it to companies, and it's their way of saying these are people who you shouldn't have any transactions with. They essentially make them non-human.
If you're on that list, you can't have a bank account, you can't get a job, I don't think you can rent an apartment. I mean, you are screwed.
Right. They give you special vouchers maybe to do some of those things, but basically that's right. You're considered a non-person. And what's most interesting about it is they do that without any due process.
Right. They just put you on the list.
Right. One day, in fact, he found out, I think, about it by reading it somewhere or something like that. Oh, no, his wife went into a bank to cash a check. And they said, we can't cash a check for you. She said, why can't you cash the check? Your husband is on a specially designated terrorist list. That's the way he finds out about it. And so the Treasury Department, in conjunction with various U.S., you know, agencies, put people on these lists. Well, we've been litigating these kinds of issues for years. The center has, the People's Law Office in Chicago, and David Cole in particular, out of Georgetown and a board member at the center. And they went to court on this case, on Mohamed Salah's case, saying you have to have due process. You can't do this. This is like you made him into a non-human. How can you do that? You know, you basically erased him from the planet without physically erasing him. And we made the claims, and then they never answered us in court. And then rather than answer us, because they probably knew that they were going to lose and get killed, is they simply took him off the special designated terrorist list.
Yeah.
So I would ask you, what kind of terrorist was he if just filing our lawsuit got him off the list right away? If they really were serious and thought the guy was a really bad guy, they might have litigated the case. But in fact, what they're afraid of is that due process standards might be applicable to their designations, and they didn't want to take the chance. his case was just absurd, so they couldn't do it. So it's a huge victory. It's a singular victory, unfortunately, but it shows the importance of sometimes going into court, litigating these cases. But it also shows the outrage of all the special designated terrorist stuff. The removal of Mohamed Salah from the specially designated terrorist list is an example of some of the cases that can be won. But we have an unfortunate circumstance and an update on a case that has been badly lost. It's the case of the Holy Land Foundation.
Well, the Holy Land Foundation was the largest Muslim charity in the United States. And after 9/11, the Bush administration closed it down. The Holy Land Foundation had been sending charitable contributions to the Palestinians and the occupied territories. They were completely shut down. The leaders of the Holy Land Foundation were tried as giving material aid to terrorists, and the head of it, Alisha, was sentenced to 65 years in prison. He said in his defense, the organizations that we were giving blankets and food and medicine to, those organizations were also being given aid by the United States government. We had no idea that this aid we were giving was going to terrorists. What you're doing to us is totally illegal and unfair.
When they were giving this aid to something called Zakat committees in the occupied territories. Zakat is the Muslim word for charity, and it's one of the pillars of the Muslim religion that you're able to give to charity. So what the U.S. effectively does was criminalize the giving to charity, criminalize Muslim religion, essentially. No one ever alleged that they were terrorists, and there was no way to know they were. And as you said, Michael, the U.S. was giving aid to these very committees. What they claimed is that the committees were controlled by Hamas,
yeah,
which was put on a special designated terrorist list.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean Hamas is terrorist. That just means the U.S. put them on that list. But they could never prove that Zakat committees were really Hamas controlled. And so the government lost the first trial against Ghassan Alashi, who is the leader of the Holy Land Foundation, and the others, because the jury said, well, you never proved that he either knew that these Zakat committees were controlled or that Hamas controlled them at all. And so in the next trial, of course, they decide to remedy that.
That's the important part of the story, because the way the government loaded up against the Holy Land Foundation in the second trial was they brought in an intelligence agent from Israel, and he was anonymous. They wouldn't identify who he was. And he testified that the Holy Land Foundation was giving material support to a terrorist organization because Hamas was somehow involved in it. But the defense lawyers couldn't cross-examine this guy because they didn't know who he was. There's a Sixth Amendment right to be able to confront witnesses against you. That's in our Constitution. And this was an extremely important case because the Supreme Court refused to hear the appeal on the Sixth Amendment right. There goes another part of the Bill of Rights.
You know, Michael, everything in the world is wrong with this case. And I remember when a few days ago when I heard that the Supreme Court had refused to review the Sixth Amendment right and the whole outrage of the Holy Land Five, who were the people convicted under the Holy Land Foundation case, I just said, justice has fled America. It's really this. Think about it. Ghassan Alashi got 65 years in prison for doing nothing but giving charity, blankets, to Zakat committees in the occupied territories. So this, at its inception, yes, it's about being Muslim and a Muslim foundation after 9/11, but it's also deeply about aiding the Palestinian people, even with humanitarian aid.
Well, the Israelis have decided just how much in the way of calorie intake it takes to stay alive, barely alive, and that's how much they're allowing the people in Gaza to have. So this is another one of those just choking the Palestinians that's supported by the American government. But, Michael, talk a bit about the conditions in prison under which Ghassan is being held.
Oh, I'm glad you raised that, Michael, because not only did they give Ghassan Alashi 65 years, but they put him in a communications management unit, what we call a CMU, in Terre Haute, Indiana. And there's two of these in the United States. And originally, they were set up, it's pretty clear, only for Muslims alleged to be involved in terrorism. Like as if Ghassan Alashi, I mean, it's ridiculous. The guy's giving blankets, to people in
occupied territory. Wasn't he a doctor or a professor?
I don't recall, but he was one of the founders of the Holy Land Foundation. So they put him in the CMU. And the CMU, and we've had his daughter, Noor Alashi, on our radio show, talk about what it's like to visit her father. he's there for 65 years, maybe hopefully he won't be in the CMU, but he's not allowed any physical contact. So since he's been in there, his daughter has enough trouble visiting him because they make that very difficult. And then she's not allowed to hug her father. He can only talk to her through glass, or through her telephone through glass. It's really an outrage. Now, the center is litigating these cases. And as we began the litigation against the CMUs, the illegality of the special units for Muslims that cut off all their communication with the world, what they decided to do is, this looks too bad, they're just Muslims, so they threw a few animal rights activists into it, so they can now claim that, well, we don't just have Muslims there, we have some terrorist animal rights people. Yeah. So the country just sinks lower and lower. I mean, I don't know, you know, the fight goes on, and we have to fight for the Holy Land Five. Our legal options are very limited right now, but it is an important fight. And, you know, I would like to be optimistic and say that the Holy Land Five and Ghassan al-Ashi will not be in there for 65 years, but it will only happen if we all understand how serious what happened here is.
We bring you a 10-minute excerpt of the speech by the Palestinian lawyer and former legal advisor to the Palestinian Liberation Organization, Diana Bhutto. Attorney Bhutto was in New York City for the fourth session of the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. The tribunal was here to give evidence on the violation of international law conducted by the Israelis against the Palestinians with the vigorous support of the United States.
Diana Bhutto, who will talk to us about the U.S.'s role in Palestine and the Middle East. Diana?
Good morning to the honorable members of the jury. I've decided this morning to deviate away from the written comments that I had initially provided and instead just try to give some testimony in terms of what is going on and how the U.S. is affecting Palestine and undermining Palestinian rights. I wanted to use my own personal experience and to share some stories of people who live in Palestine, rather than going into a long treatise about the UN and the US and their role in the undermining of Palestinian rights. Yesterday we had a very wonderful session in which we heard a lot about the UN and its abdication, the abdication of its role. We heard a lot about, in previous sessions, about the European Union and the abdication of its role. But one area where there hasn't been an abdication, in which there has been a specific undermining, is that of the United States and the role that it has played in Palestine. Now, what I wanted to do is I want to lay out for you not just what the U.S. has done, but what my submission is that the United States has deliberately attempted to change the rules of the game and to make legal what is otherwise illegal. Now, I'm not somebody who is, although I'm a lawyer, I'm not somebody who is obsessed by law. I recognize that law is derived from power. I recognize that the way that laws are made is not some organic laws, but that there is the push and power that creates laws. But that said, I think that we generally know what is just and what is unjust. And what the United States has attempted to do in Palestine is to make what is unjust seem just, what is illegal seem legal. Now, I want to first step back and pick up a little bit on what Ilan Pappe said yesterday. And Ilan said yesterday that what Israel's goal had been from 48 until the current day is to create a Jewish state in an area that was never Jewish. And the way that it was done was first through the expulsion of more than 75% of the Palestinian population in 1948, and then later through the containment of the Palestinians by viewing them either as a demographic threat or viewing them as a security threat. Now, to members of this jury, I'm certain that they've heard this term demographic threat, and I'm certain that they've experienced this idea of being a security threat in the past. And so Israel's role and the mechanisms that it used was to try to confine Palestinians into as small spaces as possible and take as much of their land as possible. And this has been a process that has gone on since 1948 and continues on to this very day. Now, this process also ended up taking shape in what is commonly known and referred to as the so-called peace process. In the so-called peace process, the goal of the peace process was to simply cement that same strategy, try to take as much Palestinian land as possible, and confine Palestinians into as little space as possible. This is why in 1993, when the Oslo Accords were signed, the remaining 22% of Palestine that had come under occupation in 1967 was now further subdivided into areas A, areas B, areas C, with area A, a small, tiny little portion of land, less than 18% of the 22%, the area in which the vast majority of Palestinians lived, an area in which it was now delegated to the Palestinian Authority, and we'll talk about that a little bit further. The remainder of the land, the vast majority of the land, area C, more than 60% of the land, was an area and remains an area that is under direct Israeli control. To understand this. But what Israel successfully did over the period of these years was not just build and expand laws, but it has now tried to change international perspectives on these settlements. If you look back to as far back as the 1967, up until the Reagan administration, the U.S. position when it came to Israeli settlements was that Israeli settlements were illegal and that they were a violation of international law. Following the peace process, and most specifically with President Clinton, that position changed to no longer being a question of illegal and a violation of international law, but now being a, quote, obstacle to peace. All right. Now fast forward to where there are now 600,000 settlers, and under the Obama administration, no longer are the settlements illegal and contrary to international law. No longer are they an obstacle to peace. But now the U.S. position is that continued settlement activity is illegitimate. Continued settlement activity is illegitimate. And so the question becomes, continuing since when? And what does illegitimate mean? In other words, the policy has been whittled down from being one that is illegal to now focusing on the continued settlement activity as being illegitimate, not illegal. And what this means is that in every context in which the U.S. has put its hands, and we hear this time and time again, and I'm sure there are some people in this room who will repeat this, who say, we all know what the solution looks like. We all know what a settlement looks like. I hear this time and time and time again. And for each person who says to me, we know what the settlement looks like, we know what the solution looks like, I ask them, really? What does it look like? What exactly is going to happen to these Israeli settlements? And in each configuration, I hear the same thing over and over again. Well, you know, we'll just redraw the borders in such a way as to accommodate these Israeli settlements. So in other words, the United States and Israel have both succeeded. They've succeeded in making legal what is otherwise illegal. They've succeeded in making acceptable what is otherwise reprehensible through this policy of simply looking towards and trying to get Palestinians to accept these settlements. Now, it's very interesting when you look at the role that the United States has played within the UN, and we heard a great deal yesterday about the role that the UN itself has not played. And it's very interesting when you look at the number of vetoes that the United States has used over the course of the past decades. There have been, from my estimations, roughly 82 times that the United States has used the veto. Very interestingly, half of those times has been for Israel's benefit, virtually half. And when you add in the number of times that the United States has used the veto in order to support apartheid South Africa, that number becomes 70%. So in other words, the United States, in terms of its usage and trying to make legal what is otherwise illegal, It has done it both in the case of South Africa apartheid and in the case of Palestine. Now, I want to just very quickly talk about what life is like for those people who are now living in these areas where Israel is trying to make legal what is otherwise illegal. And specifically, I want to talk about a very small little community called Khan al-Ahmar. Khan al-Ahmar is a very tiny, tiny community on the way down from Ramallah to Jericho. It's nestled in the hills. About 150 families live there. They have no electricity. They have no water. These are families that fled 1948 from the Nakba, the Negev, and ended up settling in this area. In 1979, Israel built a settlement and has since been expanding the settlement. It's called Kfar Adumim. Kfar Adumim is now on the hills of where Khan al-Ahmar is. If you look up from Khan al-Ahmar, you can see the lights of Kfar Adumim. You can see that they have running water. You can see that they have electricity. Now, in Khan al-Ahmar, there are a number of school children. And as is the case with people of color all over the world, the people of Khan al-Ahmar did the only thing that they knew how to do, which is resist, and struggle and resist. And so part of their resistance was that they decided that they wanted to have a school for their kids. They wanted to build a school for their kids. And they went to the Israeli authorities and they asked for a school for their kids. And the Israeli authorities came back. Now, as Ilan mentioned yesterday, the way that Israel treats the Palestinians is though they're interlopers on their own land. And they said, no, sorry, you shall not get a school because no permit will be allowed for you, and all of your structures have been built without permits, and so therefore no school. So what did they do? They resisted. They resisted, and they resisted. And they went out and collected 2,000 used tires. They went out and they grabbed some mud, and they went and they grabbed some used old oil, and they built a school. They built a school. They built the school in 2009, and almost immediately, there was a wrath upon the school. Now, in this school and in other schools like it, we have our own Alice Walker, actually. One of the young school children in one of these schools has since won a prize for her storytelling. We have our emerging Alice Walker. But as is the case with all things that are interlopers, very quickly, the school received a demolition order. And the school is now under threat of demolition. Now, the interesting thing is the reason that it is under threat of demolition is because the illegal settlers have filed a petition inside the Israeli courts saying that this school is a threat to their peace and to their security. And the court has ruled that this school shall be demolished. And so you can see that what is illegal becomes legal. You can see this perversion of justice, that what is illegal becomes legal. And this is the way the United States has operated in terms of Palestine. Now, I can go in further and talk about the military aid and talk about the military assistance and so on, but I know that we're going to have a person who's much more distinguished and much more esteemed on this, speak on this subject. So instead, I want to look again at how the United States has aimed to make legal what is otherwise illegal. And one of the ways that they have done this is by changing the roles and flipping the roles of the occupied and the occupier. Now, again, you don't need to have a legal treatise to know that people resist, that people demand their freedom, that people want to be free and will use any means necessary to achieve their freedom. But what the United States has since done, through the provision of the Oslo Accords, was that it has flipped it on its head. Rather than the occupier being required to provide security to the occupied, rather than the occupier being required to protect the occupied, we are now in a very perverse situation in which the occupied, the Palestinians, are required to give protection to their oppressor, Israel. And this is what has happened through the construction of the Palestinian Authority, through the way that the Palestinian Authority has operated, through the fact that the majority of the money that the Palestinian Authority gets is for the provision of security. In fact, more money goes towards the Palestinian Authority's Ministry of Security than goes to education and health combined. Again, this is the idea, is that it's making legal what is otherwise illegal. It is flipping it on its head. Now, a third way in which the United States has, again, flipped these things on its head is by creating a system in which Palestinians have to negotiate for their freedom. And this has been the number one push. We keep hearing this time and time and time again, over and over by the U.S. administration and other administrations. We urge the parties to get back to the negotiating table. And the question is, to get back to the negotiating table to do what? So again, the Palestinians have to negotiate their way out of their occupation. They have to negotiate their way into freedom. Again, the whole idea is that they've made legal what is otherwise illegal. They flip things on their heads.
That was Palestinian attorney Diana Bhutto speaking at the Russell Tribunal on Palestine here in New York City last month.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss. The Obama administration has conducted hundreds of drone strikes in several countries, killing civilians and a U.S. citizen. Critics point out that as the administration assassinates its suspects, it also avoids the legal complications of indefinite detention. In last week's New York Times, authors Joe Becker and Scott Shane exposed the priest-like role of counterterrorist advisor John Brennan, as he provides President Obama with the moral justification for extrajudicial murders. The framing of John Brennan's role of priestly advisor caught Ray McGovern's attention. His recent article, The Moral Challenge of Kill Lists, dissects the New York Times story. Ray McGovern is a retired CIA officer turned political activist. He was a federal employee under seven U.S. presidents in the past 27 years. He joins us today to talk more about the moral justification of targeted assassination. Welcome, Ray, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you, Heidi.
Well, we've been hearing a lot about drones recently, but I don't know that our listeners really have a handle on the scope of this problem. Can you give us some background?
Yes, there has been a geometric increase in the number of drone strikes against Pakistan and, of course, against Somalia and Yemen as well, and in Afghanistan since our new president, or not-so-new president now, Obama, took over. The figures are quite amazing. The London-based Bureau of Investigative Journalism estimates that about 830 civilians, including women and children, may have been killed by drone attacks in Pakistan, 138 in Yemen, and 57 in Somalia. Now, Yemen and Somalia, we haven't been doing it there very, very long, so it give us a little time, and we'll get those figures up. It's incredibly naive to think that this helps in any way in the so-called war on terrorism. Bob Grenier, who was chief of state in Pakistan when 9/11 happened, and it became chief of the counterterrorism center, has said that this really is counterproductive, that we're creating, and these are his words, they were creating more enemies then we are removing from the battlefield. We're already doing that in Pakistan and Afghanistan. And his particular concern is in Yemen, where all bets are off, and there's a major war going on. And if we think we can do that, if we think we can win that war using drones, well, it's just like we won the war in Vietnam using B-52s, didn't we?
What I suppose you could call, referring back to the term they used in Vietnam, the body count is really quite astounding. Over 1,000 people have been assassinated, many of them women and children. What is the legal justification for this? How does assassinating people outside of the theater of war, some of whom are not involved in anything but innocent activities, how does that comply with the due process requirements of American law?
Well, Michael, I could tell you, but then I'd have to shoot you because it's a secret.
Well, tell me anyway, and I'll take my chances.
No, I'm not worried about you. I'm worried about me.
Right. I'm more worried about me than you, Ray, but what's the answer?
Well, you know, this wonderful, insightful, incredibly dangerous article in the New York Times a week ago talked about the conundrum, as Scott Chain and Joe Becker put it, the conundrum of aligning these activities with U.S. legal and moral principles. Well, hello. Not a conundrum. That's an impossibility. You know, unless they've changed the Constitution while I was asleep last night, the Fifth Amendment specifically prevents this kind of thing against U.S. citizens and others as well, if you would take the interpretation that we've always had. Now, the Fifth Amendment, of course, talks about due process. splitting many infinitives are now Chief Legal Officer, Attorney General Holder, says, now, wait a second. It says due process. Well, that's what we do in the White House. We do due process. We don't need any judiciary involvement here. It doesn't say you have to have a court involved. So we do the due process ourselves. Thank you very much. Give me a break. Process is always, you lawyers know better than I do, due process is always incurred or involved the participation of a source outside the executive branch to give judicial oversight, judicial blessing, judicial whatever, to this kind of criminal activity. Now, what really got me there was he's talking to an audience at Northwestern University Law School, a fine law school. And from what I can gather, the audience, they all sat there and says, wow, okay, we hadn't thought of that before. Well, where are the lawyers, Michael? Where are the lawyers? My goodness, it's really quite amazing.
Ray, what do you think of the question Obama faces in evaluating the option of either imprisoning individuals and then getting in trouble for indefinite detention versus outright killing?
Well, you know, we used to say capture or kill these bad guys. Now, if you'll notice, just at the time that we killed Osama bin Laden, it's become kill or capture. And as the New York Times article mentions, I think one out of about 30 such assassinations that are known about, just one escaped assassination and was brought before some sort of court process. So, yeah, it's much easier to kill them. It's much easier to kill Osama bin Laden for a whole set of reasons. But is that the country we've become? I mean, forget the morality or the legality of it. If we're interested in learning a lot about Al-Qaeda, don't you think maybe Osama bin Laden might have been able to tell us some stuff about Al-Qaeda? Give me a break. So we zap him before he can tell us anything.
Or tell us what his motivations were, somehow okaying, or I'm not sure exactly what his role was in 9/11. He certainly was in favor of it. But Ray, let me ask you, when we get back to the drone assassinations, my understanding is that not only is a target picked out, but then rescuers are also picked out, and then people who come to the funerals of the people who have been killed are also assassinated. Is that your understanding?
Well, yes. I suppose we have to give some leeway to those poor young sergeants there in Langley, Virginia, and out there in Creech Air Force Base in Nevada, because, you know, it's really hard to distinguish bad guys from funeral participants or bad guys from first aid workers. I mean, they all look the same from 20, 30, 40,000 feet up. So, hey, if they're in the area where we know there's been bad guys, hey, they're fair game. And the New York Times reportage there indicates that any military-age male in the area of a bad guy is fair game. Now, what are these bad guys? This list. Maybe I could just draw on my own experience in the CIA. I know about lists, okay? I know that when there was a coup attempt in Indonesia in 1965, that there were lists given to the Indonesian authorities of communists. In those days, present-day terrorists were the communists, okay? How many communists on that list? 1 million. How many were killed? How many were murdered? 500,000 plus. How many were put in prison? The other 500,000. So I know about lists, and I know that they're compiled. If you go to lunch with a known or suspected communist, you are a fair game. In 1965, Dominican Republic, I was on the task force weighing whether we had to intervene there. Well, they needed some communists or suspected communists. We found 53 such people who had lunch with a suspected communist and so forth, and that list was drawn up to justify our invasion of the Dominican Republic. I know about these lists. They're incredibly stilted. They're incredibly unreliable. So for everyone who tells you that these drone missiles are really accurate, well, you could say, right, they're really accurate. But the target information is notoriously inaccurate, and that's why we're killing all manner of women, children, and other people that have nothing to do yet with terrorist activity.
That leads us into the whole issue of morality. And some Fordham graduates took a stance when John Brennan was conferred the degree of Doctor of Humane Letters, turning their backs, I believe. What do you make of the whole lack of morality in this country and in our government?
Well, it's been a slippery slope, certainly over the last decade, when we decided that our country could commit what Nuremberg called a war of aggression, spelling out what it meant when it said that it's the supreme international crime, dwarfing all other war crimes insofar as it contains the accumulated evil of the whole. You know, think torture, think kidnapping, think black hole prisons, think illegal eavesdropping, all that kind of thing. Now, the legalities can be, quote, made right, end quote, by Gonzalez or Mukasey, or in this case, Holder-type lawyers. I mean, they're expert at this kind of thing. Now, the morality of it, well, what really bothers me in this New York Times article is that these interviewees told Becker and Scott Jane that, oh, well, you know, John Brennan, the chief counterterrorism advisor, he's such a scrupulous fella. He's sort of like a priest. Yeah, he's a tough guy. Yeah, he pursues these terrorists with vigor, but he's the top lawyer at state, Ho, is quoted as saying, you know, you just feel really great that the last person to see the president before the president decides how many people to kill or assassinate is John Brennan, because he's got this real strong ethic.
The words they used were rectitude. And Harold Cole, I want to remind our listeners, was the former dean at the liberal Yale Law School. So I think when you say slippery slope, that's truly what's applying here.
You know, Howard Koh is the fellow who said when we're bombing Libya, those aren't hostilities, right?
I mean, that's right, because they didn't bomb them enough, so it falls right short of a war. That was their rationale there. But anyway, we interrupted you, Ray. Continue, because I think this discussion of the morality of targeted assassinations and giving great university Fordham, which gave you a degree, but giving an honorary degree to John Brennan, who was one of the main terror guys in the Bush administration, and instead of being prosecuted, was then put in charge of stuff and advising Obama. I think giving him an honorary degree is really something that's worth discussing.
Yeah, well, you know, it's a terrible embarrassment for me. I went to Fordham Prep, Fordham College, and I got my master's degree from Fordham. I love Fordham, and I hate to see the administration and the very wealthy trustees who have lots of money to give to Fordham determine who comes and gives the commencement address, in this case, John Brennan. You know, John, I know John. I mean, I knew him when he was a young analyst. But, you know, more recently, it was exactly a year ago that he told Scott Chain of the New York Times, almost the entire previous year, there has been not one non-combatant killed in a drone strike in Pakistan. Now, Scott Chain dutifully wrote that down, but when 75 other people said, Scott, that's ridiculous, that's preposterous, he went back to Brennan and he said, what do you mean by that? Everybody else tells me that's preposterous. Well, Brennan said, oh, well, you see, we don't really have the capability on the ground there in Pakistan to see how many people were killing. So I should have said that we don't know about any collateral damage there. Well, hello. The Bureau for Investigative Journalism in London does have people on the ground there, and they're talking in the hundreds. So, you know, if this is the moral rectitude fellow that Obama is depending on, you know, the game is lost. Now, I'd just like to say a thing about Obama and about Brennan and about the people that are doing these things. I think that you need to have some kind of personal involvement with innocent suffering. I think you have to have some sense of the injustice that others suffer to let your heart be touched by this kind of direct experience. And then your mind can change about these things. Obama's fallen in with a really rough crowd. Why he hired Brennan, knowing the things that Brennan had been very much involved in, you know, the only way I can explain it is that Obama thought he needed a really tough guy that he could advertise in cases like this, where being really tough is going to help you win the next election. You know, this business about Brennan being a sort of priest to Obama and Obama making no decisions on these kinds of things without having Brennan close by at his side, well, you know, that all depends on whether Brennan is this rectitude model that Harold Coe talks about. And I can tell you, and anyone can tell you, that the reason that he couldn't be confirmed as CIA director, and that's fact, is precisely because he is far, far from being a model of integrity or rectitude. When Obama wanted to make John Brennan head of the CIA, the Senate Intelligence Committee specifically, knowing very much about Brennan's involvement in all these things, from falsifying intelligence to, quote, justify, end quote, the war in Iraq, to all these other things that I mentioned, they said, look, you know, they told Obama's team, don't do it. Don't nominate Brennan. You're going to have one hell of a fight because we know about Brennan. And even we, who make compromises up and down, we're not going to be able to pass Brennan without a real, real bloody battle. And so Brennan was persuaded to write a letter to the president saying, I understand there's a lot of liberal opposition to my nomination, so I forego anything that would require Senate confirmation. I'm at your service. And then for reasons that Obama really should be asked about, he said, oh, well, come on down and run things in the White House. And in fact, Brennan is sitting over the head of the CIA and even the head of National Intelligence because he's in the White House and because he sees the president every day. So this is a saga that that won't end. And when Brennan was feted at Fordham as being, you know, the model kind of person to demonstrate a Jesuit education, I was so very happy that there were a few Fordham students who knew enough about Brennan and his background that they turned their back on about 15 of those. They handed out these pamphlets and orange ribbons to remind people of the role that he's played in torture. So, you know, if Obama is deciding to rely on Brennan and has been warned about all the things that Brennan stands for, it's very crass, his justification for continuing to do what he does. And as Bob Grenier, the head of our station in Pakistan and later chief of the Counterterrorist Center, as he said, we're making far more enemies than we're killing. And the whole notion of the president sitting on top of a kill list every Tuesday and saying, well, let's do, I don't know about number two, he's got three kids. Let's do just one and three, and we'll come back to two next week. Give me a break. This is not presidential, and this is not legal, and it's not moral, in my view.
Ray, we're interested in the church in Washington that you belong to and what kind of activities they do. Tell us about it and your relationship to the church.
Sure. Yeah, I was attracted to getting outside my Catholic walls when good Pope John XXIII talked about ecumenism and suggested very broadly that we really ought to open the windows and the doors and get out and learn about the truths and the values in other faith traditions. So there's a small church down in Washington called the Church of the Savior. And I found out that they were doing really, really wonderful things like preventing housing from being gentrified so that poor people would still live there, health care, jobs, addictions, hospice for people too sick to be on the street and not sick enough to be in the emergency, all kinds of things they were doing. And so I got involved with them in the 70s, and had, between my tours abroad, I would always check on them, and they were doing this or that thing. I teach at their school, the Servant Leadership School. I used to be the co-director of that. One of their things, in addition to setting up these nonprofit ministries, about 10 within about a mile diameter in Adams Morgan part of Washington, in addition to that, they like to keep track of what's going on in the world, thinking that Christians should be aware of these things, and pointing to Karl Barth, the Swiss theologian, who said, you know, when you read the Bible on your right, in your right hand, you really ought to have the daily newspaper in your left hand, okay? So that's the ethos. Now, when I started writing about what was going on with respect to Iraq, the pastor, Gordon Cosby, who'll be 94 this week, he said, Ray, you know, maybe you ought to stop being co-director of the Servant Leadership School. It sounds to me like you've got a background that gives you some credibility. Why don't you keep writing? Because these wars really seem to be the kinds of things that Christians should know about, number one, and be able to form their consciences and protest, number two, if they're unjust wars. And so I said, sounds good to me. And so I started doing this full-time, writing, speaking wherever I'm invited, interviewing. And the only thing that I had to do in return for the modest salary that they continue to give me is this. Gordon said, look, Ray, when you put your byline down, I want you to identify yourself with the Church of the Savior in Washington, D.C. And I said, Gordon, why would you want me to do that? He says, look, he says, number one, this is something the church should be involved in, and we are, and our community wants you to be our spokesman. And number two, when they come for you, Ray, they're going to have to come for all of us.
That's wonderful.
What a lovely
man.
Can you
man.
Imagine? Yeah. So that's it. You know, it's incredible that this happened to me. I feel so fortunate. Mm-hmm. I get not only a little salary, but I get incredible prayer support whenever I go out into Topeka, Kansas, or where I was, Wichita, Kansas, mm-hmm. as I was last month. It's an incredible blessing for me, and I'm very grateful.
I was just thinking when you were telling us about him, Obama's relationship with Reverend Wright and what happened there. I wanted to ask you two things. One, if you have any final thoughts, and secondly, how people can get in touch with your writings.
Well, my son has set up a website for me, and it's real easy. It's raymcgovern.com. Other thoughts, my goodness, there are a slew of them.
Words of encouragement, perhaps?
Yeah, I think that, you know, it's more than gilding the lily. It's more than, you know, looking for the silver lining to suggest that there's been one major change for the good in this country. It's a year old, and it's called Occupy.
We totally agree.
And I say that because we're just at the beginning. But when you look for proof that Occupy has incredible potential, I would suggest that you look no farther than what the president and what the top senators thought necessary to inject into the National Defense Authorization Act on New Year's Eve, which allows them to use the U.S. Army, of all things, to wrap us all up without charge, without court proceeding of any kind, put us in Guantanamo, not forever now, but just until the end, just until there are no more terrorists around, okay? Now, why would they do that kind of thing? I think they're afraid of us. I think they're afraid of us with good reason, and they want to be able to depend not on the park police, you know, not on the Capitol Police, not on the D.C. police, not on the Secret Service. Secret Service probably down in Cartagena, you know. Who are they going to depend on if we surround not only the White House, but the Congress? Well, call out the Army. Those generals will give those orders, and those poor young kids, you know, from the inner city and from the small towns in our country, they'll do what they're told because that's what they're trained to do. Witness, collateral murder, that terrible videotape. So that's what they're depending on. Now, I think that the more that not only the Park Police and the Capitol Police and the Secret Service learn that they're part of the 99%, so too will the soldiers in our Army. That's one thing. The other thing that I'll just kind of like to inject here is this, that there are many commissioned officers, former Army officers that I'm in touch with, who feel exactly as I do, that we took a solemn oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Now, we're painfully aware that there's no expiration date on that oath. In other words, when we got off active duty, we weren't sort of absolved of any duty to protect and defend the Constitution. Now, we are admittedly in some kind of a quandary as to what the appropriate moral and legal act we should be planning to contend with the fact that the Constitution has been shredded. It doesn't take any more than a junior high school person to realize the First, the Fourth, the Fifth Amendment. You know the amendments better than I, and the rest of the Constitution has been shredded. Now, what is our appropriate response to that? Well, we're at the point of realizing, number one, that it is not to sit still and not say anything. Number two, I just don't know, but I will tell you, there are a whole bunch of us that feel very seriously about this oath, take it very seriously, and are trying to think of ways that we can honor our oath in a way that would be effective. Last little point here, there are equal number of officers on active duty in our Army, so it's not a bunch of old guys like me. It's people who take this oath seriously and realize that it is not an oath to the President of the United States. It's an oath to protect and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic. So tune in. We're going to be puzzling through this, but we're not going to sit still for this.
Ray, you're such an honorable person. You inspire us. Thank you for all that you do.
Well, you're most welcome, Heidi, and it's nice to be on your program. Michael, too.
Thank you, Ray. McGovern.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Bye now.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.